This will be the secretary's third meeting with Kim Jong-chol.
That high-ranking North Korean official is now in New York City. We'll explore expectations. It's Thursday, May 31st. This is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of this program. Please join us on VOA Asia Facebook. It's on, it's working, and waiting for you. Also ahead, a U.S. government report finds religious freedom under assault around the world. The new Malaysian prime minister makes some admissions in an exclusive interview with VOA. All of that and more on today's VOA Asia. A North Korean official has arrived in New York City for talks with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo ahead of what the White House says is an expected summit between President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. The meeting comes as U.S. and North Korean officials discuss logistics for the possible Trump-Kim summit, again scheduled for June 12th. VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff has the latest.
Plans for a U.S.-North Korea summit, once in jeopardy, are now apparently moving forward. Top North Korean official Kim Jong-chol is set to meet with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Top State Department officials were optimistic about the meetings, which will be held in New York. Heather Nauer, State Department spokesperson.
This will be the secretary's third meeting with Kim Jong-chol. They've had obviously very deep conversations where they've talked about a lot of detail about what the United States expectations are. Again, I'm not going to get ahead of those meetings. I'll let the secretary handle it.
Kim Jong-chol is the highest-ranking North Korean official to visit the U.S. in nearly two decades. He attended the 2018 Winter Olympics this year as part of North Korea's delegation to the Games. The former spy chief was also reportedly involved in the 2014 cyber attacks that targeted Sony Pictures. His New York visit comes as a U.S. delegation talks with officials in North Korea's demilitarized zone, and teams on the ground in Singapore rush to finalize summit logistics. President Donald Trump, who abruptly called off the historic summit last week, is now moving forward, tweeting in part, quote, "Solid response to my letter. Thank you." Experts say the North Korean leader's decision to send his right-hand man to the U.S. is a promising start. Patrick McGeckern, Wilson Center Public Policy Fellow.
I think that the North Koreans have never wanted to pursue denuclearization, but I think that they're willing to entertain it in exchange for economic and security rewards. And so that's really, I think, the crux of the matter, to see if the United States and its allies can have leverage with the North Koreans to pursue our goals, which are the complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of North Korea.
Meantime, the White House confirms President Trump will meet with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe on June 7th, just 5 days ahead of the potential peace summit in Singapore, in a meeting that is sure to include North Korea on the agenda. Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News, Washington.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's de facto chief of staff, Kim Chang-sun, traveled to Singapore as a U.S. delegation prepares for that meeting between the North Korean leader and President Trump. Grant Newsham, senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty what is amazing to him is the apparent role reversal underway with Pyongyang actively engaged, making sure the Singapore meeting takes place.
That's the first time ever that this has happened. In the past, this has always been the Americans, South Koreans, begging, bribing, trying to do anything to get the North Koreans to come and just talk. Here it's the North Koreans who appear to be desperate to have Mr. Trump come. And that is something very different. So this is quite a development to see finally in sort of the 25 years I've been following to see the North Koreans desperate to get to the table instead of vice versa.
Why the change in attitude?
I think this is the first time there's been a president who has really put the military option on the table. Other presidents have even, such as Mr. Obama, have specifically said, well, we're not going to use the military option. Trump is something new, and his warnings that military force might be used I think have been taken seriously. Plus, there has been a fair amount of pressure compared to the past put on the Chinese economically.
We invite you to read more on our top story by following us on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. These are the top Asia stories currently trending on VOAnews.com. The U.S. Defense Department says the military will continue sailing ships near disputed islands in the South China Sea. That despite Beijing's increased complaints about the operations. Malaysia's prime minister says the search for missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370 will resume if new evidence of its possible whereabouts come to light. The U.S. military confirms a rocket artillery strike killed at least 50 Taliban leaders on May 24th in southern Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia, an annual U.S. government report. It finds that religious freedom is under assault around the world, notably in what the State Department calls countries of concern. They include Russia, Iran, North Korea, and Myanmar. U.S. officials Tuesday announced Washington will host in July its first ever ministerial meeting with like-minded allies to advance religious freedom. VOA State Department correspondent Nike Ching has that story.
Dire. That's how the State Department summarizes the state of religious freedom around the world in its annual assessment of 200 nations released Tuesday. In Southeast Asia, U.S. officials noted the desperate situation of ethnic Rohingya Muslims who have encountered violence, discrimination, and harassment in majority Buddhist Myanmar or Burma. Hundreds of thousands have fled to neighboring Bangladesh. Ambassador-at-Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, told VOA.
I think it just keeps getting worse. But that's why people have to step up more aggressively as nations and pushing back on this against what the military is doing in Burma and is happening in that country.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Tuesday, promoting and defending religious freedom is a priority for the U.S., he announced a meeting this summer with foreign counterparts.
This ministerial, we expect, will break new ground. It will not just be a discussion group. It will be about action. We look forward to identifying concrete ways to push back against persecution and ensure greater respect for religious freedom for all.
This, as the U.S. engages with North Korea on denuclearization, while also calling out the country for thousands who remained imprisoned for religious reasons. Ambassador-at-Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, said.
What we know is that you've got a gulag system operating in North Korea, and it's been a terrible situation for many, for many years.
The State Department also criticized Russia and Iran for continuing to deal harshly with religious minorities. In its annual religious freedom report, the State Department denoted progress in some nations, including Vietnam, where the U.S. just concluded a bilateral human rights dialogue. In a separate interview, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Scott Busby told VOA.
They recently passed a law on religion and belief, and they're in the throes of implementing that law, and they've been willing to talk to us about the law and its implementation, but we're still concerned that there are restrictions on the ability of individuals and churches and other religious institutions to freely exercise their right to religion.
Senior U.S. officials say promoting religious freedom is instrumental to combating terrorism and facilitating economic growth throughout the world. Nike Chin, VOA News, State Department.
Happening now in Asia, the United States military's largest region of operations will now be known as Indo-Pacific Command instead of Pacific Command. That's a symbolic gesture that underscores U.S. commitment to the Indian Ocean region. An Afghan policeman is dead after an attack Wednesday on the headquarters of the Interior Ministry in the capital of Kabul. And China vows it will fight back if the United States goes through with plans to impose huge tariffs on Chinese goods. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for staying with us on VOA Asia. An overwhelming sense of pride and optimism has gripped Malaysia following the stunning defeat of a widely despised but powerful government implicated in one of the world's greatest corruption scandals. In an exclusive interview with VOA, the new prime minister, Mahathir Mohamad, made it clear he was under no illusions about the amount of work to be done to restore the country's reputation and its finances, but also distanced himself from any blame for the damage done following his previous administration. David Boyle has this report from Kuala Lumpur.
It's 3 weeks since they voted out their government for the first time in more than six decades, and Malaysians are getting back to work with a spring in their step. Their hero is Mahathir Mohamad, the former prime minister who came out of retirement aged 92 and united with his former political opponents to topple a regime accused of massive graft. The public is reading all about it as fresh details pour out from an investigation into how billions of dollars disappeared from 1MDB, a state fund overseen by ousted Prime Minister Najib Razak. The scandal and a litany of others under Najib, who has denied all wrongdoing, has humiliated a country that had thrived economically under Mahathir, who is now widely heralded by many Malaysians as a saviour.
We now feel very blessed. We now feel very blessed because Tun Mahathir able to stand up for us. Thank you so much, Mahathir.
I cannot say much, but I'm so proud of this.
In an exclusive interview, Mahathir told VOA the task of restoring Malaysia's finances and reputation following the damage inflicted by the previous government was immense.
Well, my first 20 years as Prime Minister was fairly easy. I inherited a system that is already there. All I have to do is to introduce new ideas so that we can expedite the growth and development of Malaysia. But here I am dealing with a country that has been actually destroyed.
Mahathir says the new government has already found ways to knock off about a fifth of Malaysia's national debt, which ballooned to more than $250 billion under Najib. On Monday, he announced he would drop a multi-billion dollar high-speed rail project connecting the capital with Singapore, saying it was expensive and unnecessary. To topple Najib, Mahathir joined forces with Anwar Ibrahim, a former deputy who he once jailed following a political spat before Najib did the same. But he flatly rejects any suggestion that his own heavy-handed use of executive power in his previous two decades of rule had any influence on the abuses that followed. Political analyst Wong Ching Huat says Mahathir does have to shoulder some of the blame for what followed after he stepped down in 2003. But he also believes his commitment to reform now is rock solid.
I think a lot of people are still celebrating the fact that we have a good government. But no good government lasts unless you have a good opposition. You need good opposition to check on them, to be prepared to stand in and replace them.
Malaysians are bursting with pride after a watershed moment for their country, but the battle to create a lasting optimism is only just beginning. David Boyle for VOA News in Kuala Lumpur.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia, India and Pakistan have agreed to uphold a 2003 ceasefire agreement in the disputed Himalayan region of Kashmir, ending months of back-and-forth clashes that have left dozens of people dead. Pakistan's military announced Wednesday that the two sides had agreed to end the hostilities during talks on a special hotline. Visit VOA Asia Facebook every day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. The United Nations says women in Afghanistan who were victims of violence have little or no recourse to justice, as perpetrators of the crimes usually go unpunished. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA on the findings of a report jointly published by the Geneva-based UN Human Rights Office and the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan.
The report is based on 237 documented cases of violence against women from August 2015 through December 2017. It examines 280 cases of murder and so-called honor killings in 2016 and 2017. UN Human Rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell says one of the disturbing findings is the widespread use of mediation by community leaders, shuras, ulamas, and niergas to resolve criminal acts against women.
Now, the concern that we have is that violence against women in Afghanistan, including so-called honor killings, too often goes unpunished, despite concrete efforts by the Afghan government to criminalize these practices. Victims are often pressured into agreeing to mediation instead of the alleged perpetrator being brought to trial.
It is hard to come by accurate figures on the numbers of rapes, honor killings, and other acts of violence against women in Afghanistan. For instance, the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission reports it had investigated 5,575 cases of violence against women in 2016, but adds the number of violations was probably grossly underestimated, as most cases of violence go unreported. Throssell says UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zaid Rad Al Hussein believes mediation should generally not be used because it prevents women from receiving justice.
The High Commissioner has said that the wide use of mediation when a woman or girl has been beaten, mutilated, or murdered, or when she's been the victim of that awful concept of honor killing, normalizes such violence and makes it much more likely to recur.
The report calls on Afghan authorities to investigate and prosecute criminal offenses of violence against women. It says offenses should be expanded to include forced marriages and harmful traditional practices. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This news alert from VOA Asia reports, quote, a top aide to Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is saying that nation could go to war with China if its soldiers were hurt in the disputed South China Sea. An airplane flying from China to Vietnam turned back to make an emergency landing after cracks appeared in a window just 2 weeks after another airliner's cockpit window broke mid-flight in the country. No injuries have been reported. All the big stories coming your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. You're listening to VOA Asia. For transgender people in a conservative country like Pakistan, life starts getting tough very early. Seen as misfits in society, they're misunderstood, shirked, and forced to live away from families. While they get little help from the government, for the first time, one of their own has built a senior home for them. VOA's Aisha Tanzim visited the house in Lahore and brings us this story.
Severa is HIV positive. She's also one of the thousands of transgenders in Pakistan who are routinely shunned by their families and thrown out of their houses at an early age.
My mother is the only one who loves me. No one else likes me because I am a transgender. All my relatives and neighbors make fun of me. Even my own siblings make fun of me.
Rejected by their loved ones, they usually turn to a guru, an older transgender who provides shelter and training on how to make a living. As social outcasts in a conservative society, they do not have many options for employment. Most of them dress as drag queens and dance for men at parties, work as sex workers, or beg. As they grow older, the sources of income dry up. Guru Ashiq Bhatt had seen one too many transgenders left to die on the streets. So she decided to build a home for old or sick transgenders. Even that received resistance from the community.
I wanted to build it in the city, but people came to me and said, you will keep sick transgenders here. They will have AIDS or hepatitis C. Our children will get sick and old transgenders will roam around in our neighborhood.
She was forced to move her project to an area outside the city. Here, she provides not just accommodation, but food to people like Mehak, who has polio.
I can't roam around and beg too much because I get tired. Here, even if I can go and beg every day, I don't have to worry about how I will eat or pay my rent.
This first-of-its-kind shelter home for transgenders in Pakistan can only accommodate up to 40 people. Pakistan has more than 10,000 transgenders. But wants the government to take more interest in the welfare of a neglected community in desperate need of support. Meanwhile, Severa is grateful for the reprieve since she spends all her resources trying to pay her medical bills. Aisha Tanzeem, VOA News, Lahore.
We continue on VOA Asia. Grocery stores in the United States are locked in a fierce battle for customers who are often demanding the convenience of home deliveries. Automation is increasingly becoming part of the competitive equation. When U.S. mail order retail giant Amazon shook up the supermarket industry with its purchase of Whole Foods, America's second biggest food retailer, Kroger, responded by partnering with a British online supermarket known for its advanced warehouse technology. More from VOA's George Pudich.
First, it was the car factories that brought robots into the assembly line to increase efficiency. Then, retailers began automating warehouses to speed up mail order deliveries. Human workers no longer had to walk miles each day to pick up items from shelves and put them into packages. Robots were able to sort and locate the items faster and more efficiently, making same-day home deliveries a practical reality. Sensing a huge market opening, U.S. grocery giant Kroger decided to partner with British online supermarket Ocado, which owns one of the most advanced robotic warehouses in Europe. Investment commentator Gary White says the partnership could improve Ocado's financial health and speed up Kroger's deliveries.
It could possibly propel them into the big time. The big issue with Ocado is profits. The company has rarely been profitable since it listed, or, you know, more than a decade. Well, first decade, it didn't make any money.
These battery-operated robots can move up to 4 meters per second and communicate through an advanced 4G wireless network similar to your cell phone network. They can carry up to 10 kilograms and can assemble an order of 50 items in just a few minutes. The robots are controlled by a system similar to ones used by air traffic controllers and are capable of fulfilling 65,000 orders per week. Kroger, which operates 2,800 supermarkets in the U.S. under several brand names, says it plans to build 3 automated warehouses in the U.S. this year and perhaps up to 20 more in the coming years. With robotic deliveries already in testing, experts say grocery deliveries could become the first fully automated segment of the retail industry. George Pudich, VOA News.
And that wraps up our VOA Asia program for this day. You can get the program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com. Let us hear from you as well at VOA Asia Facebook, as well as our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Our thanks to our engineer, Greg Burns, our director, Tracy Carter, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.